Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Well, good morning, Matt.
Morning, Stu.
Second day of a new year.
It is.
We are in, as you would say.
Well, not for listeners.
The future. Well, yeah. At the time we're recording this, it is anyway.
We are. We're in the future.
We're in the future.
This is it.
Day two of 2026. Yeah. And man, I don't know about you, Matt. I remember watching, I was a very young child, but I remember watching 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Mm.
And in my mind, I'm going, there's no way we're ever going to get to 2001. Mm. And here we are, a quarter
of the future. You're showing your age now, Stu.
Seriously. Oh, yeah, thanks for that. Yeah. Well, this is welcome. Glad to have you with us. We are continuing with Thrive Deeper, and we're going to close out the book of Ecclesiastes today, which I'm sure many of you are going, oh, phew, thank goodness for that. But I think there's a lot to learn from this book. And we've,
there sure is.
We covered from chapters 1 to 3, and really they focused a lot on the state of oppression, observations about oppression and community reflections on wealth. But we're going to move into chapters 4 and finish it out to chapter 12, which switches a little bit to reflections on wealth. Wisdom, aging, and of course the ultimate call, which we'll come to at the end, fear of God and keeping his commandments.
And I think the overall thing that we want to keep in mind here, what is really being done in this book, that it's highlighting the paradoxes of life, the sort of meaningless, not in that there isn't some overall meaning that's apparent to God. It's not ultimately meaningless, but it doesn't have a meaning that we can necessarily grasp all
yes.
the time.
Yes.
In fact, not even much of the time. In fact, the point here is that he goes through the various aspects of life and whatever seems good, like there's this theme throughout this book that, okay, there are some things that are better than others, but even the some things that are better than others, even things that are good, there's still problems associated with those things.
Yes. And again, remind our listeners, the phrase under the sun is mentioned a lot through this book. And really what we're talking about here is someone without an eternal perspective, really. Someone who's living in this world.
Yeah. But not, okay, so we would say, yes, like we know that there is more. Okay, that's probably the difference between us and the writer of Ecclesiastes in terms of what we know from subsequent revelation. Okay, we know that there is something beyond death. And actually, at the end, I think he
acknowledges that.
The frame editor of this book actually alludes to that.
Okay? Yes. Yeah.
But our sense that there is something else beyond this, we're still locked within this.
Oh, like, that's exactly right.
Like, it just alludes to the fact that there is more, but we don't know exactly what that more is. And what it leaves us with is this paradoxical situation where life is like this continual unresolved equation. Nothing quite works out. And even good things, like taking a classic example, the most sublime thing in life, of course, love, you know, and the thing that's held up as being the most important thing in life. And yet in this life, love is a very costly thing. It costs us a lot of pain when love is bereaved. You know, the more that you love, the more vulnerable you are to pain. And in fact, the worst kinds of pain are the loss of those that we love. So this is the paradox of life, is that everything that is good, everything that is sublime comes with this sting in its tail. And why is this? And this is the paradox that he's dealing with. And this is what he means by meaningless. It's not that, as I said, there isn't some ultimate meaning to it, but we don't really grasp why things happen. And there's something within us, and he alludes again and again to this pursuit of wisdom, you know, this desire to understand reality in its wholeness, but we just don't have access to that kind of knowledge. And so to me, the book of Ecclesiastes is a very humbling book. It's a book that expresses the issues with trying to transcend our standpoint, which we never really can. But it is actually giving us really good advice in the midst of all of the paradoxes, in the sort of pain of what we can't know and don't see. It's actually giving us some really good advice.
Yeah.
So let's keep moving through this. Worthwhile, I think, Stu?
Yes, totally. Absolutely. And I think for me, and we said this right at the very start, I think if you read it in the context of saying, if all you're striving for, if everything you're striving for is what we can achieve under the sun, then you are going to be disappointed because everyone ends in the same place.
Yeah.
You know, and which he reflects on.
That's right. So for example, all of the evil that's done in the world. And he talks about the power of the oppressors in at the beginning of chapter 4. And
yeah.
So he talks about evil that's done, but people do good things. But this is where it flips then. But he says in verse 4, I saw that all toil and all achievements spring from one person's envy of another.
Yeah.
So yes, there are good things that are being done. But the paradox is that that often sort of springs from this place of envy and competitiveness
yes.
with one another. And that drives us, and that can actually achieve, good things can come from that. But, you know, is that a good thing? And so yeah. this is all part of this strange equation of life for him. But there's, as I said, a continual comment, and I've highlighted the word better, you know, better this than
yes,
that. Like
yes.
there are some things that are better than others. Nothing quite makes sense, but verse 6, better one handful with tranquility
yes, yes.
than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind.
Talking about wealth there, of course.
Yeah, that's yeah. right. Talking about wealth. He talks about the man who's all alone and how painful that is. And in some ways, okay, he's talked about competitiveness and the way we compete with one another and, you know, that inevitably fractures relationships. Okay, well, then man should just be alone. But then he talks about the misery of that, right? And so he goes on in verse 9 to say, and this is a very famous verse, you know, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. If one of them falls down, the other can help them up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Mm. If two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. So that very famous passage is in that context of describing that some things are better than one, and even though, you know, relationships come with a lot of issues, it's still better. It doesn't.
Yes,
there's still lots of issues with
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
but it's better.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, that speaks to the model of the church being together, collectively supporting one another when
yeah.
one person's struggling. The idea of the community of the church is for the mutual support and encouragement of each other. So, you know, again, that's a great pointer to don't go it alone, because
yeah.
there are plenty of people who are going to be willing to help you, and it's the best way to be, or the better way.
Yeah,
be,
that's right.
Sure.
There's some advice around worship in chapter 5,
yes.
and it's interesting that this appears in the midst of the book. There's still a perspective here of life oriented around worship, but a recognition that in the same way as a lot of toil and achievement, wonderful things can be achieved through, yet nevertheless through envy, we can also sort of rush into a place of worship in the wrong way as well. So,
and I reflected on this a little bit, because I was thinking, you know, how often does it become, it's Sunday, we've got to go to church. It becomes this kind of habitual routine activity, as opposed to actually coming with the intent of actually bringing your worship to God and hearing from him. But I also like the one that where he says, better to draw near in obedience than to offer the sacrifice as fools do. In other words, don't just carry on with life and then come and ask for forgiveness every week and keep doing that. That's not the goal. The goal is obedience so that less do we have to come and offer the sacrifice, so to speak, in a sense.
And there's some good advice here. Do not be quick with your mouth. Do not be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. You know, we need to be careful about coming with this over-enthusiasm that says, I'm going to do all of these things. And it's have an element of modesty and realism about yourself and a humility that says, in a sense, comes before God with a sense that, you know, progress is slow, we grow slowly, don't run ahead, don't try and run ahead of yourself. I think there's good advice.
Totally.
There's good advice there.
And right at the end of verse 7 in chapter 5, it has those words which become a pattern. So fear God. All of this is, so the main thing here is, you know what? Fear God, particularly in the context of worship and coming into his presence. We then look into the realities of wealth. You know, again, the fact that there is still, you know, oppression in the world, and often wealth brings with it oppression because the wealthy tend to want more. Never is enough. Enough is never enough. So verse 10, the one who loves money is never satisfied with money, and whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with income. This too is futile.
See, this for him is part of the paradox, because...
And he's a guy who can say this... Potentially.
Yeah, that's right.
Solomon, who's got all the money there is to have.
So we want to gain, and we want to do well, and we want to prosper. And it's not, the Bible doesn't take a negative view of that. The idea of, you know, abundance is a blessing. And when, you know, when we have abundant yield, we should celebrate that as a blessing from God. And yet, it also comes with a problem. This is the consistent theme throughout this book, because the more that you have, the paradox is that the less satisfied you can be. And perhaps there's a sense here in that the more that you have, the less you value, which I've seen that noted elsewhere, this idea that abundance creates this paradoxical effect that whenever you have a lot of something, you value it less. And so you actually enjoy it less.
Right.
So I think this is what he's pointing to.
Easy come, easy go is kind of what you're saying.
A little bit. Yeah. But value, we tend to value what is perhaps rare or what we've had to work hard for.
Mm.
I mean, you think of the concept of value. Whenever you have a lot of something, you take it more for granted. It's not as, perhaps your enjoyment in it isn't as heightened as, you know, when, like if everything was made of gold, we wouldn't, you know, if gold was like stones, it would have no value to us. But if you're walking along one day and you see a piece of gold among the stones, it's the very rarity of it that makes it such a novelty.
Yes.
And, you know, it's the same with, you know, there's a famous story in famous book by Voltaire who's in similar ways points out the sort of the paradoxes of life. It's very Ecclesiastes-like, a book of his called Candide, and he tells the story of a rich man who has all of these amazing things, all of these artworks, all of this beautiful stuff, but he's intensely bored with it all. He's got so much of it all that he's just so bored with it all, and his boredom is actually tormenting him. And there again is this Ecclesiastes-like observation that Voltaire is making of life that I think is aligns with this.
Yeah, totally.
The other thing that the writer of Ecclesiastes here points out is that often a lot of wealth comes with the fear of losing that wealth. So he says, but as for the rich, their abundance permits them no sleep because there's a sense in which you become then quite dependent on what you have.
Yeah, I like the bit just before that, actually, because I think this really brings that home. The sleep of the worker is sweet, whether he eats little or much.
Yeah.
In other words, for most of us, when we're toiling and working, if you don't have much, there's not much to lose, so you get to sleep pretty quickly. But the abundance of the rich permits him no sleep. I think that's great. A great one.
And throughout this book, and this is, again, a fairly constant feature, we have this continual exhortation to enjoy the day, you know, carpe diem, seize the day, enjoy what you have. This isn't saying forsake all of these things. It's not saying that we shouldn't enjoy the things of life because of these paradoxes. No, it says enjoy what you have when you have it. So verse 18 of chapter 5, this is what I observed to be good, that it is appropriate for a person to eat, to drink, and to find satisfaction in their toilsome labor under the sun during the few days of life that God has given them, for this is their lot.
Yeah.
To accept their lot, be happy in their toil, this is a gift of God, he goes on to say. So it's very much encouraging us to stay within our perspective, accept what we've been given, and to enjoy it for what it is as a gift of God.
Yeah.
That's good advice.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Into chapter 7.
Yeah.
Where we move into sort of wisdom, some wisdom sayings here. And chapter 7 and 8 really speak a lot to wisdom, righteousness, and towards the end, the problem of injustice in the world.
Lots of better than statements are right through this.
Yeah.
A good name is better than fine perfume. Mm. You know, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. It's interesting, that statement, and because he goes on to say in verse 3, frustration is better than laughter.
Mm.
Why would he say that? It's a strange statement to make. But in the context, I think he's saying that there's something about this house of feasting that is somehow out of touch with reality. He's, I think, alluding to a state of mind where you perhaps use pleasure to anesthetize yourself from these elements of reality. So I think, you know, he's saying it's actually better to be in touch with these painful aspects of reality and to learn to live with that, to feel the frustration of it than to just laugh it off. Because it's a state of being more in touch with the reality of things, essentially.
Yeah.
Again, verse 13 of chapter 7, consider what God has done.
Yeah.
Who can straighten what he has made crooked? We can't fix this in an overall sense. It is going to be this way. And it's not saying, you know, it's not saying that we shouldn't try to make things right where we can.
No, of course.
But consistent with that theme, I think what he's saying here is that we just need to accept that the world that we live in is full of these
paradoxes.
Imperfections and paradoxes. Now, of course, in the light of the biblical story, we don't expect the world to be a reasonable place where everything happens that it should. So I think that's an important perspective here as well. There's a fallen world perspective that we can set this within as well, where things actually don't work out the way that they're meant to. But verse 14, when times are good, be happy. And when times are bad, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, no one can discover anything about their future. Mm. So you're going to go through, you're going to go through hard times. You're going to go through good times. When the times are good, enjoy it because it's fleeting. That's the sort of sobering, simple but sobering wisdom of this. The good thing about time, of course, is that it keeps moving. It keeps moving. So, you know, when you're in the bad time, you'll keep moving through it because, you know, time keeps moving. You're going to stay on that conveyor belt. You're trapped in it. But that's also the case when times are good. Mm. So use the opportunity when times are good to prepare yourself
for
when things get hard. Simple wisdom, Stu.
Absolutely.
But good. And the other bit of simple wisdom in chapter 8 is obey the king. Now, we don't have kings, but we are told in Romans 13 to obey the authorities and not cause unnecessary trouble for ourselves. And I think it's something like that. There's been a little bit of discussion. Is the king that he's talking about here, is this God? You know, the sense that, well, God does whatever we want. He's like a king. He does whatever he wants. You might not like it, but you've just got to go with it. No, I think that's probably stretching it a little far. I think he's actually talking here, actually about obeying authorities. They're not always going to do what you want. This is part of the chaos of life. Chaos is in those in authority as well, and you've just got to learn to live with that.
And I think that's important for Christians because it's difficult for us to live with integrity in a world that it seems that the complete opposite of what we would expect is happening. People who are perhaps, you know, certainly not following God, perhaps we might even say evil in some ways, seem to have all the wealth and all the power, and yet people who are trying to do good seem to be the ones who are struggling. And that's what we can't try to explain. That's the paradox.
Yeah.
We have to just trust God.
Yeah. And it's okay to observe that, okay, things shouldn't be like that.
Yes.
But the point of this perspective in Ecclesiastes is that they are. This is the way that life is. It's broken. It's a little chaotic. It's kind of random. And we need to learn to live with this. And so verse 15 of chapter 8, so I commend, he says, the enjoyment of life because there is nothing better for a person under the sun than to eat and drink and be glad, right, when it's given to you. Be glad when you have it.
And then the last couple of verses in that chapter, again, this is our wanting to understand and explain everything. This is verse 16. When I applied my mind to know wisdom and to observe the activity that is done on the earth, even though one's eyes do not close in sleep day or night, in other words, I'm constantly trying to find answers.
Yeah.
I observed all the work of God and concluded that man is unable to discover the work that is done under the sun. Even though a man labors hard to explore it, he cannot find it. Even if the wise man claims to know it, he is unable to discover it.
Yeah. The big problem here for the writer of Ecclesiastes is the existence of death. And in chapter 9, he talks about this explicitly, that, you know, the issue for him is that there is this border, you know, to life that is this great equalizing thing so that, you know, whether you live a good life or whether you live a bad life, it's just an equation that doesn't work out. And it's interesting that this actually becomes, for the Greek philosopher Plato, this actually becomes part of his argument for the immortality of the soul. Because for Plato, you know, life is this, like the perspective of the Kohelet, or the writer of Ecclesiastes, it's this unresolved equation, right? Some people live good lives, some people live bad lives, and everyone gets to this same destiny. There must be, he thinks, there must be something beyond death that equalizes that equation. Now, of course, that gets affirmed. And in fact, even in the book of Ecclesiastes, the frame editor is going to affirm this, that there is, you know, God will bring all of our deeds into some kind of final judgment.
Yeah.
He doesn't explain that at depth, but he does affirm that perspective. But it's interesting that this for Plato is something that's already been noted. The point is that the writer of Ecclesiastes is, in a sense, taking this limited perspective and looking at life under the sun in and of itself.
Yes.
And I think the exhortation is here that we should not expect life to be fair. It's not fair.
Yes.
Fair doesn't happen within the limitations of this life. And there's no more primal cry from the human heart than it's not fair. Mm. And that's true. He's, you know, he recognizes that and he recognizes the pain of that. But his exhortation is we have to just learn to live with that because that is the way that life is. It's not fair.
And I think his frustration expressed in the certainty that death is, There is no, but yet the unpredictability of life, you know, it's like, here's this one thing that's the only certain thing, and yet everything else that we're meant to enjoy seems so unpredictable. And so he goes on then to say, make sure we, as you said before, make sure we enjoy God's gifts in the present rather than trying to think into the future of what we might want or.
Yeah, that's right. So yet again, in verse 7, go eat your food with gladness, drink your wine with a joyful heart, for God has already approved what you do. Always be clothed in white and always anoint your head with oil. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, so on and so forth and so forth. And whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. I mean, this is the valid wisdom in the midst of this book. It isn't just saying only care about, you know, what enjoyment. No, but it's saying, no, enjoy what you have.
Yes.
With gratitude. You know, don't get so caught up in, am I going to have this tomorrow still? Or am I as secure as I want to be? Or do I have enough? Just the more you think like that, the more you try and think out of the bounds of what you have in the here and now, the more you'll be actually robbed of the enjoyment of what you do have because you're trying to transcend your perspective.
Spot on.
That's the wisdom of this book.
And I don't know, you know, I'm sure all of us have been to funerals and often heard how people are striven for wealth or for certain situations. And as they reflect, as his family reflects, it's like, gee, I wish I'd realized what really matters in life. And it's actually enjoying the moments with my family and with my loved ones and the little things, not working so hard that I have no time for that because I'm worried about providing for my future.
Yeah. You know? As it goes on in the last part of chapter 9 and chapter 10, this is still advocating wisdom, and there's lots of individual bits of advice that, you know, listeners can read through. At times there, it sounds a lot like the, you know, book of Proverbs.
Proverbs, yes.
And I think that's important to you because it's not throwing everything that the book of Proverbs says about the way that life, you know, works. It's not throwing that out. All of that is still being advocated. But
it's not a guarantee.
But it's not guaranteed. And I think that operating from within your perspective and not trying to transcend it, I think is the key bit of advice that can make sense of that. So we're given some advice in chapter 11. The first verse is variously translated and some translations, I'm not sure what you've got there, Stu, but some translations say, cast your bread upon the waters.
Yeah, that's what it says.
I've got the NIV here. It says, ship your grain across the sea. I think the NIV actually has probably done a good job of interpreting what that is about. I think it's talking about still invest. Just because things are random and things might not always work out the way that they should, doesn't mean that you should, you know, not invest and try and make some profit. So, you know, ship your grain across the sea. Of course, in ancient times, you know, famously risky. Right? Trade, right? So it's still advocating involvement in trade, but you just...
It's interesting. Mine
can't necessarily be guaranteed.
I sort of took a slightly different interpretation on that, and because mine actually says, send your bread on the surface of the waters, for after many days you may find it. Give a portion to 7 or even to 8, for you don't know what disaster may happen on earth. And I kind of thought about that more as generosity rather than hoarding stuff for yourself. Give it away. You never know when one day you might need someone to give it to you.
Yeah, it is. No, I think that's totally valid, but it's also talking about the distribution of risk. Distribution of wealth, like invest in many ventures, it goes on to say. So I think he's giving us advice because life is random, distribute the risk. It's just a good bit of advice, really.
Okay, good. Moves on into unpredictability of all of the outcomes of our investments, so to speak. We need to accept that it is unpredictable. Verse 9 of chapter 11, rejoice, young man, while you are young, and let your heart be glad in the days of your youth, and walk in the ways of your heart and in the sights of your eyes. But know that for all of these things, God will bring you to judgment.
There we go. So, as we come to the end of the book, there are absolutely these, this is not from the frame editor, this is from Kohelet or the teacher.
The teacher, who was probably considered to be possibly Solomon, or a Solomon type.
someone who's in some senses taking the character of Solomon, if not Solomon. So I think this is here, and the frame editor is going to refer to this as well. And I think this is where we get to the real crux of the advice. And all of the book of Ecclesiastes, as perhaps complex as it is for readers, particularly like us, too, I think one of the problems for us is that we like more straightforward. Just give me either straightforward teaching that just makes sense, you know, straightforward exhortation. There's nothing straightforward about the book of Ecclesiastes.
No, that's right.
And I think it's good for that reason. I think it pushes against that desire just for straightforward, formulaic, you know, advice. But as we get to the end of this book, I think it comes to the crux of things. And I think this starts in the beginning of chapter 12, remember your creator in the days of your youth, right? Mm. So here's the thing. He's advocating a way of life. This is where it's important in your youth, right? When you're young, live this way, right? This is the way to navigate through this. Remember your creator, right? Before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say, right, before all the hard times.
Yes.
You know, when times are good, you know, youth it's a great time. You might be tempted to just run off with your youth and no. That is the time to find God. And I think it's so true, Stu. I think the time to find God, and in fact, we know this, the most people that come to faith do tend to come to faith in their youth, because then you've got your whole life before you and you've got a light to carry through good times and bad times. And this is the light that shines at the end of this book of Ecclesiastes. You know, verse 6, remember him, remember God before the silver cord is severed and the golden bowl is broken, right? It's a picture there of a lamp being sort of cut and falling and smashing to the ground. It's a picture of our mortality, right? It's a picture of things going wrong, when things get unhinged, when things break, when things remember, hold on to God through that. And of course, this is where it finishes. Why should we do that? Because verse 8, because meaningless, says the teacher, everything is meaningless, right? Mm. So you're not going to understand it, but you've got to hold on to the one who does.
Yes.
And who can help you navigate through this. And so the conclusion of the matter, in verse 9, not only was the teacher wise, but he also imparted knowledge to the people. So this is acknowledged by the frame editor who's writing this last bit. This is wisdom. It's tough, but there is wisdom here. So he goes on, he pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find the right words, and he wrote what is upright and what is true. The words of the wise, he says, are like goads. It's like a goad is you goad on a camel or a horse. You know, it's like a whip in a way. Yeah. It, you know, drives us on, right? Come on, keep going. Like, their collected sayings are like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. And of course, the shepherd is God, right? It keeps us in place, keeps us in firm, keeps us together. Be warned, my son, he says, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study wearies the body. Again, this is, I think, an allusion to just trying to be overwise, trying to understand
everything
too much, trying to transcend everything. Mm. And we're so prone to this, Stu, I think, in our cultural context, wanting to understand. I just don't understand. I want to understand.
Yes.
I think the book of Ecclesiastes is telling us to relinquish that. Relinquish that to God. You focus on this. And he says in verse 13, now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. For God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good and evil. And so the conclusion of the matter is fear God, which is a recognition of the awesomeness, the majesty of God. He is the one who rules over the earth. It's for him to know, it's for him to understand, and it's for us to walk with him and obey him in all things.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.